It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the U.S. Supreme Court will make a decision soon in Wisconsin's redistricting case. Our guest breaks down some of the most controversial tactics in partisan redistricting, cracking and packing. First, it's time for our weekly look at national politics. Members of Congress are weighing in on President Trump's meeting with the North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. Primary elections around the country last night put the president's influence on his party to the test, and polls show the president's approval since the election has gone up among Republican voters. You can join in. Our question for you this week, do you identify as a member of one of the two major political parties? Do you consider yourself an independent or a third party member? If a pollster called you and asked you to identify yourself by party, what would you tell them? And has it changed over the last few years? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Harry Enten is a senior writer and analyst for CNN Politics. Harry, welcome back to the show.
It's my pleasure to be back with you.
Before we get to primary elections and poll results, let's look at the big news of the week, President Trump meeting with Kim Jong-un. What has reaction been like on Capitol Hill from Republicans and Democrats?
Well, from Democrats, it's been mostly uniformly, you know, negative. Obviously, there are some people, some members of Congress who say, you know what, it's better to negotiate or try to negotiate than it is to try and go to war with somebody. But I think that there's a lot of skepticism that Kim Jong-un really wants to negotiate at all, and whether or not he's just using this as an opportunity to advance his own causes. Among Republicans, again, it's mixed. I think that there's a lot of leeway that Republicans on Capitol Hill will give President Trump. But at the end of the day, we're seeing statements that indicate that there is a lot of skepticism that Kim Jong-un, again, is going to actually do any negotiations rather than just do a photo shoot with the president.
Let's give a listen to Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer talking about the meeting.
It is worrisome, very worrisome, that this joint statement is so imprecise. What the United States has gained is vague and unverifiable at best. What North Korea has gained, however, is tangible and lasting. By granting a meeting with Chairman Kim, President Trump has granted a brutal and repressive dictatorship the international legitimacy it has long craved.
And Harry, that's been a concern. Back when Senator Barack Obama was running for president, he said he'd be willing to meet leaders like Kim Jong-un without a precondition. And he was criticized for that. Is that a concern that in the past has united Republicans and Democrats?
I mean, I would say that the most interesting thing about what you just said with concern to former President Obama was that Republicans were adamant back then. Adamant. There's no way he should meet with them. What is he doing? He's giving them a photo shoot. And, of course, we've seen party identification come into play big time here, where Republicans are more willing to give the President of the United States now, a Republican and Donald Trump, a little bit more leeway. But, again, I think that the overall theme on both sides is even if they are willing to say, you know, he should meet or, you know, negotiations better than going to war, overall, they are very skeptical that anything will occur, and they recognize that by meeting with Kim Jong-un, they are giving him a photo shoot and giving him a world stage visit where essentially he's, you know, being pumped up and he's giving legitimacy.
What does American public opinion have to say of this idea of the U.S. president meeting with the leader of North Korea?
Well, you know, I do wonder whether or not how much people actually understand about the issue, but overwhelmingly, if you look at the polls, people are in favor of meeting with Kim Jong-un. I think the latest poll was something along the lines of 76% were in favor, 19% were opposed, and most people do not want to go with North Korea. I think that this is a lasting effect of the Iraq War, where people do not want to get into wars unless they're absolutely necessary. But again, just because the American public believes something on a particular issue, they may not be the most informed on it. It's not necessarily clear whether or not the President of the United States should take that, especially on something as key and important as this.
Talking to Harry Enten from CNN Politics, senior writer and analyst there, looking at some of the top stories in national politics. You follow all the time, Harry, President Trump's approval ratings. Multiple polls showing that President Trump's favorability among Republican voters has made a big jump since he was elected. What have those numbers shown?
Yeah, it's really quite interesting. You know, if we go back to the 2016 campaign, what we'd often say is that Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton were the two least liked candidates of all time, and people were just basically choosing the lesser of two evils. And I think if you look at President Trump's own favorability ratings, even among Republicans, at the end of that campaign, it reflects that. Although most Republicans liked President Trump, then disliked him, if you looked at the net favorability rating, which is essentially the favorability rating minus the unfavorability rating, with 100 being the highest score, his net favorability rating was actually at only plus 50. Which is good, but it's really not that great. Now, compare it to where it is now with Republicans. It's jumped to, on average, plus 72, which is much closer to the maximum of plus 100. So it's a real indication that President Trump has gained a lot of points with Republicans, and he's simply put just a lot more popular than he used to be.
And I could see that being a few different things happening. It could mean that the never-Trumpers don't identify as Republicans anymore, so the people who stayed are proportionally more in favor of him. Or it could mean President Trump has brought people who consider themselves independent enthusiastically into the Republican Party. They love him. Or it could mean it's the same Republicans as it always was. They just like him more. What do you see?
Well, yeah, if you look at the numbers, it's probably a little bit the case that there's some people leaving the Republican Party and some people entering it. But even if you control for that, there's a number of studies that show that indeed it's the same people who have simply become more, quote-unquote, accustomed to his face, you might say, and like him more than they used to. So there's no doubt that among people who tend to vote Republican over time, that he is more popular than he used to be.
I want to bring on a caller. We ask people about their party ID and how they identify themselves. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Byron is with us in Oconomowoc. Byron, hi.
Hi.
How do you identify yourself, and has that changed?
Yeah, I identify myself as a libertarian now. And I would say I grew up in the Republican Party, but I definitely left that in my early 20s.
And what motivated that change?
Well, I'm just concerned with in the environmental factors. I like that, but then I'm also concerned about gun laws, and I want those to not be affected. But I just see a lot of restrictions on, like, freedom that the Republicans want to attack, specifically like medical marijuana or business that pertains to that.
Byron, thanks a lot for that call. And Harry, I think it's easy sometimes to say there's this group of Republicans and they all believe roughly this group of things. Democrats, they all believe this group of things, and people in the middle. It's actually, for most people like Byron, I think, or a lot of people, a grab bag.
Yeah, it really is a grab bag. I mean, you know, if you look at the data sets and you sort of ask people their views on different individual issues, very few of them actually are all, say, all Republican or all Democratic, you know, as we might normally identify it. But at the end of the day, given this country, since we have two major parties, what essentially happens is people choose the issues that are most important to them and say, okay, which is the party that most closely identifies to me on that particular issue or issues.
Now, with what we were talking about with President Trump and his approval of among Republicans, that takes us into the primary elections around the country, Harry. South Carolina, Virginia, Maine, Nevada, North Dakota. We had a couple ones here in Wisconsin. We're going to talk about that more later in the show. Where do you want to start? South Carolina is one we've been looking at. Some Trump influence there, potentially.
Yeah, I mean, South Carolina's first district, Mark Sanford, who was the incumbent representative there, Republican, your listeners may better remember him as the guy who went on the Appalachian Trail, but didn't really when he was the governor of South Carolina. It turns out he was having an affair. He was reelected to Congress just a few years ago, and he has been a chief critic of the President of the United States. Very conservative. Mark Sanford's very conservative by most metrics, but he was a chief critic of the President of the United States, and he went down to defeat last night in that district. Again, someone who was far more pro-Trump, as well as someone who was endorsed by Trump in the final minutes. I don't know how much of an effect that endorsement actually had, given it happened so late in the day yesterday, but it was pretty clear that Katie Arrington, who was Mark Sanford's opponent, was playing up Sanford's opposition to Trump, and it seemed to very much hurt Sanford in that primary.
Is there an overall lesson emerging this year that if you're running as a Republican, you are running as a Donald Trump supporter?
I mean, yes. I mean, if you want to win, that's certainly the case. You don't have to be a Donald Trump supporter, but then you're probably going to lose. I mean, you know, if we harken back to what we were talking about a few minutes ago with how much more popular Donald Trump is within the Republican Party, that seems to be having a large effect on these congressional races, these congressional primaries. I mean, think about the chief critics in the United States Senate, for example. Think of Bob Corker, who's a senator from Tennessee, or Jeff Flake, a senator from Arizona. These are people who've been critical to Trump, and eventually they had to drop out of their own primaries, in my opinion, because they were so critical of Trump and the primary voters just didn't want to hear about it.
Yeah, let's listen to Bob Corker talking about this very phenomenon.
We're in a strange place. I mean, it's almost, it's becoming a cultish thing, isn't it? It's not a good place for any party to end up with a cult-like situation as it relates to a president that happens to be purportedly of the same party.
Yeah, you're only going to call President Trump a cult-like phenomenon if you're not running for re-election, as Senator Corker is not.
Yeah, I would say that's exactly the case. Although, you know, it's very interesting. I think it's perhaps because Donald Trump has a different ideology that, you know, perhaps some of these Republican senators are used to, or the fact that perhaps he's a little more, you know, full of himself, some might say, than former presidents, or at least outwardly full of himself than other presidents might have been. But, you know, I don't remember back in, you know, 2002 when George W. Bush was the president of the United States and he had a approval rating among Republicans that was very similar to Donald Trump's right now. I don't remember many Republicans who were running against him. And there were very few people who would say that the attachment to President Bush was cultish. So, you know, I think, you know, yeah, Donald Trump has a perhaps some cultish phenomenon going on, but at the end of the day, that's the way with most presidents, and you wouldn't see incumbent senators attack the president of the United States is the way that some senators in this particular case are attacking Donald Trump on the Republican side.
Talking to Harry Enten, senior writer and analyst for CNN Politics, about the top news in national politics. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Answer our question about partisan ID if you'd like. Do you identify yourself as a Democrat, Republican, Independent, other party? Why? And has it changed over time? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation, get to more of your calls coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Harry Enten, senior writer and analyst for CNN Politics, looking at some of the top stories in national news this week. Back to your calls now. We'll go to Aaron on the line in Sturgeon Bay. Aaron, hi.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah. What's your party ID, Aaron?
Well, my party ID right now, it's different from what it used to be. I grew up in a very Democratic family. In fact, I tried to persuade my grandmother to run for president years ago. I learned to draw on the back of Democratic posters because she was a big DFLer up in Minnesota. But now I live in Wisconsin, and, you know, I always voted Democratic my whole life. I voted for Obama twice and Clinton. But this year, this past election, I voted actually for Andrew Bisaggio, a private lawyer out in Washington State. I wasn't very happy about either candidate. And I never liked Donald Trump, but however, I have to say, after seeing what he's been doing what other politicians should have been doing, these career politicians who never solve anything so they have something to run on, I think he's showing a new way, and we shouldn't think about politics, our parties, and different, the right wing and the left wing are part of the same bird, and there's good Republicans and bad Republicans, or good Democrats, bad Democrats. We should vote for people with ideas instead of parties.
Aaron, thanks a lot for the call. A lot there to chew on, Harry. But this idea he has a party ID becoming less important. We should be voting on people, and he's impressed, though he didn't like him at first, by Donald Trump.
Yeah, I mean, we have certainly seen that if you ask people whether or not they're a Democrat or Republican or an independent, that the independent percentage has certainly gone up over time. Of course, underneath that, when you ask which party do people generally lean towards, the percentage there, Democrat plus Republican lean, is about the same as it has been for a while now. But it is certainly the case, you know, if you look at the 2016 election, that there was a much higher percentage of people voting for a third party or an independent candidate. So that caller right there, I don't think, was unique in that way.
Let's take another caller on our question of the week about people's partisan identity. We'll go to Jim with us in Rice Lake. Jim, hi.
I describe myself as a liberal Democrat. because I believe in the principles from Jack Kennedy through Lyndon Johnson to Bobby Kennedy to Bill Clinton to Barack Obama, that concerning the least advantage of our society, it has always been a liberal position, which in Latin comes from liberalis, the qualities of a free man to help others. While the party of Nixon, Reagan, and certainly Trump, their attitude towards the poor is to say, get a job. Well, I think within the Democratic Party, there is a belief that there, but for the grace of God, go I. So my politics is principled, it's consistent, and it's normative. And I'd be interested in your guest response.
Jim, thanks. So a different answer there, Harry. He's a Democrat, and sounds like he's sticking a liberal, too, and he's sticking with that label.
I think he's sticking with that label as much as I stick with my New York accent. So, you know, he's consistent. I would say certainly it is the case, you know, perhaps while people haven't necessarily been as consistent as they used to be in terms of their party and their ideology, there's been a lot of moving around the last few years, that most people do stay with their party and their ideology. You know, there's that old thought process, you get more conservative as you get older. That's not really the case if you look at studies. And more than that, if you look at the last few years and you look at, you know, the people who identify as Democrats and the people who identify as Republicans, Democrats have become more liberal over the last few years and Republicans have become more conservative. And so I think there are more and more people who are becoming like that last caller.
Jim, thanks for that call. We'll take one more caller before we move on to a couple more news stories. Steve is with us in Sun Prairie. Steve, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I used to be more Democratic until what happened in 2011 when the senators of Wisconsin left the state. And it just seems to me that the Democratic Party has become more cult-like. The party is not a big tent if you look at ideas. If you look at the Republican Party, you have John McCain and Rand Paul. I mean, how can you get any more diverse than that from an idea perspective? So, well, I consider myself more libertarian now. I know they can't win, so I end up voting with the Republican Party just because the Democratic Party went off the deep end.
Steve, thanks a lot for that call. Harry, are voters often pushed, not so much pulled by another party, but pushed away by something they don't like in what was their own party?
You know, that's very interesting. And in fact, a number of studies have shown that something called negative partisanship has become much greater over the last few years. That is, you're voting for one side, not because you necessarily believe in the issues that are articulated by that side, but you hate what the other side is articulating a lot. And that is something that has certainly been the case, and your caller is a perfect example of that there.
Thanks for that call, Steve. We're talking to Harry Enten from CNN, looking at some of the top political news of the week. The ongoing investigation related to the Trump campaign, Harry. Now, Michael Cohen, longtime lawyer for Donald Trump and the Trump Organization, sounds like he is changing or ending his relationship with his current legal representation. Rumors, anyway, that he might be ready to cooperate with federal prosecutors. Unconfirmed rumors. Different news outlets are reporting this differently. What do we know? How big a deal is this?
I mean, obviously, if he were to, in fact, flip, as the old saying might go, it would be a very, very large deal. You know, Michael Cohen has been close with Donald Trump for forever. You may, in fact, remember during the campaign there was that famous clip of Michael Cohen saying, "What polls? What polls?" on television. And in fact, I remember when I was a reporter at The Guardian, you know, he was Trump's personal lawyer back then. So, you know, if Michael Cohen were to flip, it would be a very large deal. But as you pointed out, it's not particularly clear that he will, in fact, do that. There are some signs, you know, that he's getting rid of his lawyers. Some news outlets are reporting that he's getting ready to, in fact, flip, but there are other news outlets who suggest otherwise. In fact, they suggest that this is, in fact, just a smoke signal up to the President of the United States in order to say, you know, I'm in trouble, I need help. So we'll have to see what happens. He could end up, you know, cooperating with prosecutors in the next 24 hours, but he may not.
And there's this deadline going on. There are all these documents following a raid of all of his stuff. Basically, his lawyers were going through trying to see what they would try to get redacted, what was germane to the case. You kind of want lawyers in action when you've got a deadline like that approaching.
Yeah, you would think so. And I think, you know, people are obviously in all these instances trying to read tea leaves, trying to figure out, you know, what is he doing? Why would he possibly be doing that? Which I think is part of the reason what you just pointed out, why people think he, you know, getting rid of the lawyers, it seems awfully odd that he would be doing that unless he was getting ready to cooperate with prosecutors. But, of course, we'll have to wait and see. Sometimes lawyers do things for strange reasons.
Right. And now there's this whole legal story, of course. This is also a political story in an election year. What do we know, Harry, about what public opinion is on the Mueller probe? Is this something that might motivate people to vote one way or another or to not vote?
It doesn't seem at this particular time that most of the things involved with, say, the overall Russia investigation are necessarily charging up voters, at least making voters change their mind. Obviously, among the base of the Democratic Party, there's a large belief that Donald Trump has done something seriously wrong, and we have to go out and we have to stop him. But most voters, especially those in the middle of the aisle, are not necessarily convinced by this. I will point out one thing, though, and that is when President Trump fired James Comey as head of the FBI, we did see that President Trump's approval ratings did drop. So if President Trump were to do something, say, you know, really try to get rid of the special counsel in some way, then that could, in fact, impact the midterm elections. But in terms of the day-to-day of what's going on, we're not seeing much of an impact on public opinion.
Want to wrap up, Harry, by getting your take on the midterm elections and whether, as some people predicted, a blue wave is on the way. In addition to the primaries around the country, we had two previously Republican-held legislative seats. One went to a Democrat in a big swing. One stayed Republican. What is your take? What are your prospects for change or not?
I mean, if you were to look at the special elections overall, both on the state legislative level, as was last night in Wisconsin, or the congressional level, as, you know, has been in Pennsylvania and Alabama, so on and so forth, we do see a large swing towards the Democratic Party, a swing that is consistent with them gaining control, at least in the House of Representatives, in 2018 in the midterm elections. But it should be pointed out that the generic congressional ballot, which is a measure of the national environment that asks, you know, are you going to vote for the Democratic or Republican member of Congress, what we see is a race that, although Democrats are ahead, they are not ahead by enough, given how the district lines are drawn, to guarantee them control of the House. In fact, it would be more looking like Democrats, say, favored, but not overwhelmingly so, say, a 2-3 chance or a 3-5 chance.
We'll leave it there. Harry, thanks for joining us again.
Thank you.
That's Harry Enten, senior writer and analyst for CNN Politics, with us for our check-in on the top national political stories of the week. Cracking and packing. You might have seen these terms if you've been following Wisconsin's redistricting case before the U.S. Supreme Court. But how does redistricting work? How gerrymandered is Wisconsin? Our next guest spent some time researching gerrymandering in the state, and she's with us now to talk about it. Malia Jones is a social epidemiologist with the UW Applied Population Laboratory. Her recent piece for wiscontext.org is titled Packing, Cracking, and the Art of Gerrymandering Around Milwaukee. Malia, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me, as always.
Well, I'm going with a hard G instead of gerrymandering.
I noticed that.
I've been convinced by evidence out there that it's supposed to be a hard G. Just getting that out there, out front. Now, let's start with redistricting, though, Malia. Why do we do this every 10 years?
Redistricting happens every 10 years because it's written into the United States Constitution that we should have a census every 10 years in order to equally apportion the seats in Congress. And what that means is that every 10 years, the U.S. Census Bureau counts all the people all across the nation at every address. And then the next year, we redraw the state assembly, state senate, and also congressional district maps in order to try and create districts that are equal to one another in population size.
And the Constitution says we have to do this. It doesn't exactly specify how states have to do that, and there's a lot of latitude from one state to the next.
That's right. The process of creating the district shapes is a state-level process, and it's actually varied over time. Different states have different rules. The Wisconsin State Constitution has a number of guidelines written into it about what the district should look like, but doesn't really specify the process itself for drawing districts.
Yeah, what kind of guidance do we have here in Wisconsin? There are not absolute rules, but there are some rules. We're not supposed to have those really bizarre-looking districts that are famous in other states and in American history.
Correct. So one of the rules that in addition to the equal population size rule, which is universal across all the states, Wisconsin specifies that we should have districts that are compact, and that means that they should not have those sort of wild-reaching, bizarre shapes that you think of as being gerrymandered. I don't go with the hard G usually.
That's okay.
So
I'm not dogmatic about it.
Gerrymandered. So that the compactness rule is one of the guidelines for Wisconsin in our constitution. It also specifies that the shapes should try and maintain communities of interest, which is typically defined as just a group of people who have common legislative interests. So it could be a city or a town or a group of voters in a neighborhood who have similar interests in terms of representation in government.
And are they supposed to use, ideally when they can, county lines and not have ones blur across lines when possible?
Right. So part of maintaining communities of interest is the Constitution also says that whenever possible, the district should follow administrative boundaries such as municipalities, counties, and so on.
And the state legislature is in charge of this here in Wisconsin and a lot of other states.
That's correct. In most states, the state legislature controls the process of drawing the maps and then passing those new maps into law.
Let's get into a how-to of redistricting if you want to help your side out, where the gerrymandering comes in. And you focus in your piece a lot on cracking and packing. Let's talk about each of those in turn. What does it mean if I'm trying to draw these legislative boundaries if I'm cracking?
So the two main processes, as you said, to achieve a gerrymandered map, both have the same aim, and that's to minimize the number of seats that the other party gets in this case, the state assembly as a whole. And so cracking is the process of you take a group of voters, say a group of mostly Democratic-leaning people living in a neighborhood, and you split them across several different districts that are each majority Republican voter. And that way that block of Democratic-leaning voters doesn't ever achieve a majority in any of the districts, and you end up with tipping the balance of power towards the Republican side. And I should say this happens on both sides. Mm-hmm. Democrats and Republicans both have gerrymandered, and I'm using this is what's under review by the Supreme Court.
Right. We'll dig more into that case and the particulars in Wisconsin. And then packing is kind of the opposite of cracking, but it kind of goes hand in hand in a lot of ways.
Right. So packing is they operate in tension with one another, and packing is the process where you draw a shape that crams as many people on the opposing side into one district as possible. So you end up with a district that's really densely opposing party. And of course, the opposing party is all but guaranteed to win that seat, but you have excluded all those voters from the neighboring districts. So in terms of the balance of power in the legislative body as a whole, it tips it towards the side in power.
And you give examples in the piece, just you share some maps, ideal square maps where you take, you know, a certain proportion of Republicans and Democrats. If you draw the line one way, Democrats have more seats. If you draw it really craftily with packing and cracking, the other side has more seats.
That's right. It is definitely possible to tip the balance of power substantially if you do a careful job of drawing those boundaries to crack and pack blocks of voters.
Talking to Malia Jones from the UW Applied Population Laboratory about her piece at wiscontext.org, looking at redistricting in Wisconsin and a big case in the U.S. Supreme Court. Okay, those are how they work in the abstract. Now, here in Wisconsin, because of the quirks of elections in the past, one party didn't control all of state government. They couldn't gerrymander if they wanted to. But this time around, it was different. Republicans in the last redistricting held all the power. So what is being charged in this case that they did with that power?
Right. So what we had in 2011, when it was redistricting time the last time around, we had Republican control of both houses of the state legislature and the governorship. And that meant that the Republican Party was really in the driver's seat with respect to drawing those boundaries. And the maps that were produced through that Republican-controlled process were challenged in court at the state level and then at the federal level. And a federal three-judge panel actually found that the state assembly district map in Wisconsin is a partisan gerrymander and is therefore unconstitutional. That ruling was challenged, and it was heard by the Supreme Court in October, and we're expecting to hear the ruling on that any day now.
And as you said, both parties have done this in various states around the country, going back a couple hundred years, really. But the question at stake here, it seems like, is, okay, yeah, you can play around with this a little on the margins. Is there a point where the way you've drawn the map, the way you've divvied people up, cracked and packed, is there a point at which it's too far?
I think that is, so that question and the question of how do you know when it is too far, how do you measure this thing, are really what the at the heart of this Supreme Court case. It turns out it's quite a hard thing to measure. You know, sometimes we look at a legislative district and it has a notably bizarre shape and you can sort of see it and say, wow, that looks weird. That looks really like it could have been drawn purposefully to achieve some end, right? Other times you just look at the landscape of how people are spread out and how, you know, voting by party tends to follow social class and economic and race lines pretty closely. And we live in a very segregated society spatially. So anytime you draw a map, even if you were to have a computer do it, you would end up with some districts that were really heavily leaning one way or the other in terms of party. And that question of how do we know when it was purposeful in order, you know, drawn purposely to achieve political aims, and how do we measure that, are what's at the heart of the case.
And we even have mathematicians weighing in on this. And I think, actually having depositions to the court saying, here is a possible mathematical measurement, and here's how it plays out in Wisconsin.
Right. So the court, the lower court focused really strongly on this measure called the efficiency gap. The efficiency gap measures something known as wasted votes. And it's basically the number of people who cast a vote and ended up not being represented by the party they voted for across all the voters in the whole state. So it measures how many, how it sort of measures the degree to which districts were cracked and packed. In the Supreme Court case, there were a couple of other mathematical measures also presented to look at other issues like compactness and the odds that a similar map or a similar outcome could occur by chance were also presented to the Supreme Court. And yeah, there's a whole group of people at Tufts University who are running a lab on the math of gerrymandering.
And now as we start to wrap up every Monday morning, those of us in the media wake up and look to see if the Supreme Court has dropped their ruling on this. They haven't yet. Could be any day now. They could reject Wisconsin's maps. They could uphold them. Whatever they do, we're going to start over again in just a couple of years, right?
That's right. So if the Supreme Court upholds the lower court's decision, then that means our current state assembly and by implication also our state Senate map are unconstitutional. And so we'll have to redraw them basically immediately. And it's sort of unclear how that process might unfold. If they do not uphold, if they overturn the lower court's decision, then we're going to have to redraw the maps anyway, like we always do, just after the decennial census, which is coming up in just 2 years. So redistricting will be coming up either this year, most likely, or early next year, or right after the census.
Malia, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That's Malia Jones, social epidemiologist with the University of Wisconsin Applied Population Laboratory. She was with us to talk about her project looking at gerrymandering in Wisconsin. You can learn more over at wiscontext.org. Right now, alcohol-related driving deaths in Wisconsin dropped by about half between 2006 and 2016. During the same time, fatalities tied to driving under the influence of other drugs more than doubled. It's a problem that the Wisconsin Department of Transportation addressed in a public service announcement.
Here's a dose of reality. Driving under the influence of prescription painkillers is just as illegal and just as deadly as driving drunk. In fact, drugged driving deaths in Wisconsin have increased nearly 200% over the past 10 years. Help prevent drugged driving, and let's achieve zero preventable deaths on Wisconsin roadways. Driving on pills kills.
With the opioid epidemic and the issue of marijuana legalization gaining traction around the country, the challenge of how to reduce drugged driving is likely to continue. Jim Headland is the principal of Highway Safety North, consulting on behavioral traffic safety research, policy, and management. He led a report on this topic. Jim, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here.
And we heard some of the numbers from Wisconsin. Are we part of a national trend when it comes to drugged driving?
Yes, you are. In fact, you're quite comparable to the rest of the nation. Dead drivers, for whom we have the best data, now have more drug positive than alcohol positive over the last 2 years. That's the first time.
And alcohol is still a problem, I know, but why do we see drugged driving? And that includes a lot of ground, but why do we see drugged driving on the rise?
Probably because drug use overall is on the rise. The two big things are, first of all, marijuana use. As more and more states either legalize marijuana recreationally or legalize it for medicinal use. And the second, of course, is the opioid epidemic, which is a national crisis with opioid overdose deaths skyrocketing. So if you use it, you probably will use and drive.
Do we have enough research on this? You mentioned that, yes, we're testing people after fatalities. Do we have a sense of drugged driving in, say, non-fatal accidents? Do we need more information about what's going on out there?
We absolutely need more information. What we have now is a good general indication that drugged driving has gone up, and there are lots of measures of this. But we don't have precise numbers because most drivers who are in crashes, which are not fatal, or arrested for impaired driving, do not get tested for drugs.
Is law enforcement, for the most part, aware of this problem and taking measures on it?
Absolutely. Law enforcement is very aware, and they are doing their best. It's just harder for drugs than it is for alcohol. Alcohol is alcohol, and everyone pretty much understands it. Law enforcement understands it. The tests for impairment by alcohol are very straightforward. Drugs, there are a whole panoply of drugs, and they affect you in different ways. Some are uppers, some are downers, so the signs and symptoms differ. Law enforcement needs considerably more training to be able to recognize impairment by drugs and then identify what drug is causing the impairment.
Now, does that same problem, you know, alcohol is one thing. When we talk drugged, we're talking a variety of legal and illegal prescription and over-the-counter medications. Does that make it harder for awareness campaigns, given that that's a whole bunch of different stuff?
Absolutely. The simple awareness is you should not drive while you're impaired by anything, fill in the blank. Drugs certainly can impair, but they need not. Prescription drugs, for example, are prescribed for a very good reason, and you may well be better off taking your prescription drug as prescribed than if you did not. But non-prescription drugs, illegal drugs, those affect your body in ways that can affect your driving, and you should not drive while you're impaired by them.
What is an effective way to get that message out to people to think about prescription and illegal drugs in terms of driving?
Same way that one gets the message out about alcohol, just do it. And Wisconsin has taken the lead in a campaign to warn public about prescription drugs. You can do it for non-prescription drugs, for illegal drugs, in the same way. These drugs affect your body. They can impair your driving skills. You should not be driving after using them.
Talking to Jim Headland with the Highway Safety North, talking about drugged driving. It's on the rise in Wisconsin and around the country, talking about efforts to change that. Let's look at illegal drugs in particular, Jim, and you were involved in a report that really focused on that. When it comes to impairment, what illegal drugs have you the most worried?
The two that are most common are marijuana, which is by far and away the most common drug found in drivers, dead drivers, drivers on the road, and opioids, of which there are many. Now, marijuana is interesting because depending on what your state you're in, it's either legal or illegal. In Wisconsin, it's illegal. You go to adjoining states, and it's legal. So in some senses, in states where it's legal, it has the same sort of status as alcohol does. Yes, you can. It's legal to drink alcohol, but it's not legal to drive while you're impaired by alcohol. The same thing can be said for marijuana. It may be legal, it may not be legal, but it's illegal to drive while I'm impaired by it. Opioids are another issue. Now, again, they can be legal if you're taking them for medicinal reasons, or they can be illegal, which off-the-street opioids often are. The same comments apply. It's illegal to drive while you're impaired by them.
I want to bring on a caller now. Owen is with us in Wyawega. Owen, hi.
Hey, Rob. Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to ask the expert this question. Now, marijuana, of course, is illegal in Wisconsin no matter when or where. But say you had marijuana in your system, because I know that it stays in your system 30 days for, like, urinalysis or a blood test. Is that correct?
Yes and no. What stays in your body for a long time are metabolites of marijuana, and those certainly are not impairing. What law enforcement tests for when you do a blood test is THC or delta-9 THC. That's the impairing component, and if you find that in your body, yes, you're impaired.
Owen, thanks for that call. So I think his point is, do certain drugs stay in your system longer? Does testing for them at the site for marijuana, as you just talked about, and other drugs really give us a sense of impairment as opposed to just remnant presence, I guess, in a bloodstream?
It can't tell impairment precisely, and drug presence doesn't necessarily mean impairment. Metabolites certainly are not impairing. For the example of marijuana, THC is impairing, but how much THC impairs by how much, that's far more difficult to figure out than the equivalent thing for alcohol.
Thanks a lot for that call. Do you want to see police be testing more people, not just, again, after fatalities, but testing more people after traffic stops when there is that suspicion of impairment?
Absolutely. What happens all too frequently now is if law enforcement detects impairment and finds that alcohol is causing some of the impairment, they will stop and they will not test for drugs. But there's increasing polyuse, alcohol plus drugs. And until we do tests for drugs, we really don't know the extent of overall drug impairment and the polyuse drug plus alcohol.
Is it a concern that we're going to need a whole big toolkit of different tests? I mean, alcohol is one thing, and do we need the opioid test, the marijuana test, the cocaine test? Is that too much to ask of a police department?
No, we're not going to do that. The really hopeful thing right now is oral fluid tests. You put a little saliva on a swab, you stick it into a machine, 5 minutes later comes back a reading, positive or not, and identifies which family of drugs is causing that, is present in the person. So it's just a single test that will test all sorts of drugs.
Very briefly, Jim, are you optimistic that states are going to be able to tackle this problem?
I am indeed. And a number of states are doing pilot tests on these oral fluid devices right now. So I hope to see good results on those by this time next year, certainly, and maybe even before then.
Jim, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Glad to be there. And thank you for helping spread the word.
That's Jim Hedlund, principal at Highway Safety North, consulting on traffic safety, policy, and management. He joined us to talk about the problem of drugged driving in Wisconsin and around the country. Drugged driving showing big increases in testing on highways here in the state and, again, throughout the United States. Soccer's World Cup kicks off tomorrow. My question for you is, will you be following the action? Let us know if you're a soccer fan, which national team you're backing, which club you're a fan of. Email ideas at WPR.org or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We woke up to some extra World Cup news this morning. The U.S., along with Canada and Mexico, have been selected to host the 2026 event. So we'll have lots of opportunities to catch the big games, and the U.S. men's team will have 8 years to get ready and hopefully make it into the competition as the home team. Tomorrow on Central Time, we'll talk to the author of the book, The Language of the Game, How to Understand Soccer. So if you have questions about soccer, if you think you could get into the game, if you understood it a little better, we want to hear your questions as well. Or if you've been brought into the game by your kids, that is my story. They've been playing for years, and we watch a lot of soccer in my house now, and I think I understand the game a lot better. I want to hear your story as well. You can send in your questions or your experiences, email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Or you can tweet us at Central Time WPR and then join us for the conversation tomorrow. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.